All right, welcome everyone to the second session of the 2018-2019 Football Scholars Forum. It's a great pleasure to have with us Sebastian Abbott, the author of The Away Game, The Epic Search for Soccer's Next Superstars. And Sebastian, this is his first book. He is a former AP reporter, bureau chief in Islamabad, so very familiar with difficult contexts. And I'm going to turn it over to you in just a moment. Just want to introduce the rest of the group that's online right now. We've got Andrew Guest in Portland, Oregon, Brian Wissala in Geneva, Switzerland, Daniel Reichi in Beirut, Liz Timms in East Lansing, and Itamar Dubinsky in, I believe, Portland, Oregon. And we're still waiting for a couple more people to join. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Sebastian in New York City, and he'll give a few preliminary remarks, and then we'll open it up to the group. If you want to use the chat function in Zoom as a virtual queue, that would be great. So welcome, Sebastian.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Peter. I really appreciate it. And it's nice to meet everybody on the call. Actually, Danielle, who's on the call, met back in Doha in 2014, right when I was beginning the research for the book. So it's fun to reunite with him. I guess I'll start out just with a brief summary of the book. I mean, I don't know how many of you all have read it or are familiar with it, but I thought maybe it'd be good to give a brief summary and then maybe just a background on how I came to do this book. And then we can kind of open it up and see where the conversation leads. But the book is basically, and I'm going to apologize for using soccer rather than football for the non-Americans on the call, but the book is about the largest talent search in soccer history, which was carried out by Qatar. Over the span of the decade, Qatar held tryouts for over 5 million 13-year-old boys, mostly in Africa, looking for soccer's next superstars. The program was led by a Spanish scout who helped launch Lionel Messi's career at Barcelona, a guy named Josep Colomer, who used to be the youth director at Barcelona. And every year, they would choose a handful of kids and then train them to become professionals, initially at Aspire Academy in Doha, and then they eventually set up a satellite academy in Senegal, where they would trade the Football Dreams kids. Eventually also bought a team in Belgium that was in the second division at the time to serve as a farm team for these kids once they finished the academy, with the hopes that then they would move on to the biggest clubs in Europe. So that's sort of a general summary. In terms of how I came to do this, back in 2007, when the program first started, I was living in Cairo working for the AP, and I'm a big soccer fan myself. I've played since I was 5 years old all the way through college. I actually played at Princeton for Bob Bradley before he became the U.S. national team coach, which was fun. And so I've just been a big soccer fan my whole life. And one day, I think it was towards the end of 2007, I was running on the treadmill in the gym, and a commercial came on TV that showed this gleaming new sports academy in Doha called Aspire. And there was a kid in the video who was juggling a soccer ball. And as a soccer fan, it piqued my interest because I'd never heard of Aspire. And so I went back home, Googled Aspire, and it just so happened that they had recently launched this Football Dreams program. And so I think it was January or February of 2008, I flew to Doha when the first class of kids from Africa were there for their final tryout, and spent a few days with them and wrote an article about it for the AP. And even at the time, I thought this would be an unbelievable book or movie or documentary or something, because it to me was just such an astounding story. That sort of brought together a whole host of issues, not just, you know, soccer, but, you know, international politics and the state of development in Africa and a whole bunch of different things. But I wasn't really in a position to pursue anything more than an article at the time. But it was always one of my favorite articles that I ever did while I was at the AP. And I eventually left Cairo and moved to Pakistan, where I spent 4 years sort of splitting my time between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And in 2013, I was kind of thinking about a new, you know, being ready for a new challenge. And I thought back about the Football Dreams program, and I wondered what had happened to it. I wondered if anybody had ever written a book about it. And so I did a bit of research, and I realized that the program had only gotten bigger. It started out in 7 African countries, and then had eventually expanded to, I think, about 16, over a dozen in Africa, and several in South America and Southeast Asia. And nobody had ever written a book about it. And so I contacted Aspire, and eventually, although it was kind of difficult how to figure out who to speak to there, eventually connected with the head of marketing and communications, and eventually to the head of Aspire, a guy named Ivan Bravo, and went and pitched the idea of writing a book about Football Dreams, an independent book, not something that they would control or finance. And again, that took months to try and get the necessary permissions, but I eventually did. And in 2014, actually left my job at the AP to work on the book full time, at least at first. And over the course of the next 4 years, spent about 4 or 5 months in West Africa doing research, a couple months in Qatar, about a month in Belgium, and various other places. And it was just an incredible odyssey and a fascinating project, you know, both in terms of the international nature of it, but most of all because of the human story of these African kids that they found. I tell the story of the book really through the lens of 3 African boys who were found at the beginning of the program, and, you know, where they came from, you know, how they grew up, how Qatar found them, what happened to them, and then also why Qatar was doing this. The whole project was started effectively by a guy named Sheikh Jassim, who's a member of the Qatari royal family and is sort of the brainchild behind Aspire. And his goal was to build a world-class Qatari national team, eventually linked up with this Spanish scout, Joseph Colomer, and they launched Football Dreams together. So that's sort of the long and short of it. So I don't know if that's a long enough overview, but why don't I open up to see where people would like to go with the conversation.
No, that's great. Thank you. Would anyone like to ask the first question? No one's... I see a hand up from Daniel. Oh, you're so good. You even use the actual hand-raising function on Zoom. Bonus points. All right, Daniel, over to you.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Yeah, the connection is a little flimsy, but go ahead.
Yes, I know. I'm running connection. This is Beirut. This is Lebanon. Peter tweeted today the paragraph from your book, summed up by saying the next superstar was not found. So when I was reading with a big joy, so for me, a major topic became the issue of age cheating. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is the main reason that superstar was not found, that it seems that many of the supposed to be 13-year-olds that were scouted were in reality 16, 17, 18. So those in Aspire responsible for the search for the next superstar, were there at the beginning, how much were they age cheating, or were they, because maybe when they looked before in South America for talents, it was not a big issue. So were they of this issue, how much were they surprised?
No, and
was this from the beginning something they were looking at? So maybe...
Yeah. Thanks very much, Daniel. You cut out a little bit, but I think I got the gist of the question, which was, you know, how much did the folks at Aspire who were running the Football Dreams tryouts anticipate that age cheating was going to be a big problem? I think, to be honest, they seemed somewhat naive about it, or at least Joseph Colomer seemed somewhat naive about it. You know, when I asked later on, you know, because I began my research in 2014 for the book, although I'd obviously written an article beforehand. 2014 was when I really started the research for the book. And so the program had been running for multiple years at that point. And so I asked at that point, you know, about the age cheating issue, because obviously it's something that people who know a lot about African soccer, write a lot about African youth soccer, know is a big problem. And they said, well, you know, we know that's a big problem, but I think so. Can somebody mute their,
Gérard needs to unmute.
Okay, there we go. So at the, you know, when I spoke to them, when I started the research for my book, they said, you know, we know this is a problem, you know, when kids come for the final tryout in Doha, you know, we do our own testing, our own kind of risk test is the same kind of test that FIFA uses to try and determine age of kids at say the, you know, Youth World Cups. We do our risk tests to make sure that the kids are the right age. And so I thought at the beginning, I said, okay, well, they've actually got a way to address it. And that means that they're going to have a big leg up over a lot of folks who are looking for talented young soccer players in Africa, because it really is one of the biggest challenges that they face. Although when I spoke to Joseph Colomer about it, he seemed a little bit more blasé. He said, you know, we're not trying to find kids to play in sort of a specific, you know, league, like a, you know, a specific age group team necessarily. So, you know, he gave the example of, I think, Samuel Eto'o. He goes, who cares if Samuel Eto'o at this point is 30 or 33? He's an incredible player. And I was a bit surprised by that because, you know, when you speak to others who are very focused on African youth soccer, they say the age is the most important thing you need to focus on. So, you know, when I started my research in West Africa, actually on the ground, again, I went with this idea that Aspire was doing their own testing, so it wasn't going to be an issue. But when I, you know, began to really poke around and meet with, you know, the kids I was focused on, their friends, their family, I started to get the sense that it was a bigger issue than Aspire either let on or realized, and that most of the kids I was focusing on were older than they said they were. It's not an easy thing to uncover how old exactly a kid is, because basically everyone around the boy is trying to deceive you. You know, understandably, they don't want to do anything to hurt a kid's chances of, you know, achieving his dream and making it to Europe and becoming a star. But, you know, the friends, the family, the coach, everyone is trying to sort of disguise the real age of the player. But I realized that if you asked enough indirect questions, you could start to get an idea of whether a player was significantly older than he was saying. One way is to, when you're interviewing their good childhood friends, is to ask the childhood friends how old they are. And sometimes I'd be interviewing a kid who was, you know, the childhood friend of a football dreams player who was supposed to be 21. And, you know, at the end of the interview, I'd ask the good friend, by the way, how old are you? And the kid would say, oh, I'm 30, you know, and you'd say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. So when you were 10 years old and he was one, you guys were hanging out. And so there were multiple, instances like that where I started to realize that these kids were older than they were. And as you pointed out, Daniel, in your question, I do think it is one of the big reasons why the program wasn't more successful than it was, because they didn't get this age issue right, especially at the beginning. And those were the boys that I was focused on, the boys from the beginning of the program. And again, most of the folks you talk to in African youth soccer say it is the most important thing to get right. If you are picking kids who are significantly older than you think they are, then, you know, you're just making it that much harder for you. And it's already incredibly hard to pick the right kids to begin with.
Great. Brian, you've got the next question, and then Andrew, I believe, after that.
Okay. Hi, everybody. This is Brian Messala, currently based in Geneva, but I'm from Kenya originally, born and raised in Nairobi. Anyway, first of all, Sebastian, congratulations on this book as your first book. It's really, really well done. And yeah, it's my latest read. And you can tell I was very fascinated just going through the whole book and the three stories. At some point, I mixed the three stories up, but that's my reading. And my question would be, first of all, how did you, I know you're a journalist, but how did you really get to know the stories of these young boys? You follow them, you follow their stories up to when they at some point go back to their countries, their neighborhood, especially those who didn't make it through to what they thought would be the next Messi or the next Cristiano Ronaldo. That's my question regarding the book. And then as a follow-up, I'm also very keen on the age cheating thing, and I would like to say from the onset, I believe age cheating is not the reason for the failure of this project. First of all, I think that the project, and I would love to get your views on this, the project itself was ill-conceived in terms of taking raw talent from Africa, boys who you think are as young as 13 or 14 or 15, and putting them somewhere in a Doha, expecting them to develop professionally. And I think in your book there is a lot of reference to their how they are socialized and how they adapt to their new environments. And in your introduction today, you also mentioned the development of Africa. So I wouldn't really put age cheating on top of the of your list as one of the reasons this project failed. The project itself is ill-conceived because it fails to look at the personal development of these young boys. And yes, age cheating is a big problem in Africa, but somehow we fail because of the state of development in Africa. We are more or less forced to cheat so that we can compete with the more advanced players in Europe. If you take a player at 14 in Europe and a player at 14 in Africa, they have been exposed to totally different. Like, there's a huge gap between what they have been exposed to. Personally, I played amateur football in Kenya, and I've also played here in Switzerland. I can tell you the gap is huge, which is what necessitates the cheating. It's not that we don't have the talent. So mine is not a question as such, but I would like to hear your comments after following your book, because I thought that was what you were trying to allude to most. The state of development of football and the economy in general in Africa as being the major reason why this project failed.
Thanks for your questions. I appreciate that, and for your kind comments about the book. So in terms of the first question about following the boys, you know, when I started the research for the book in 2014, I didn't know which boys I was going to focus on. It was actually a very difficult decision because there were a lot of boys who had gone through the program. A lot of them had very interesting stories, and it was a very difficult process to try and choose, a manageable handful of them to be the main characters in the book. And I wanted to find boys who, you know, all had very interesting stories, but were very different and had different backgrounds and different trajectories in terms of what happened to them. So it would be sort of representative of the program writ large. And so what I did was I interviewed over 24 boys who had gone through the program and eventually kind of narrowed it down to about a half a dozen or so that I thought might be main characters. And then I went and spent a bunch of time in West Africa, both with the boys and their families and their friends and their coaches, to learn more about where they came from and what they went through. And eventually, did kind of hone in on the three main boys, Bernard, Diwandu, and Ibrahima, who I focus on the book, although there are obviously others who are mentioned. And I tried to, because I wasn't with them at the very beginning other than when I went and did that initial article in Doha. So I had to kind of try and recreate what their experiences were like, basically kind of from birth, you know, through being selected for Football Dreams and their experience at the academy and beyond. And, you know, as you pointed out, some of the boys ended up having to go back to where they came from because they didn't succeed and weren't able to make it in Europe, which is what they all aspired to do. And many of them, I went and met them back in their home countries, whether that be Ghana, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and talked to them about what their life was like after not having achieved their dream. And that was one of the hardest parts of the story for me, is because you know, I started out working on this book being most mesmerized by the idea of, you know, if you take the continent of Africa with 1 billion people, you know, soccer is by far the most popular game. You've got tens of millions of kids who are playing it religiously. And you have, you know, a country with basically unlimited wealth. And you have, you know, a scout who has a very good grounding in the game through a major club like Barcelona. If you combine those three variables, imagine the superstars you're going to find. And that's sort of what captivated me about the book at the beginning. And that's an interesting aspect to it in terms of what you would look for and how hard it is to find. But at the end, what I thought was most memorable or left the strongest impression on me in my experience researching and writing of the book was the boys who didn't make it. Because you realize that kids who make it are basically a total anomaly. I mean, the probabilities are so small of any kid actually, you know, achieving success in Europe that it really is sort of the needle in the haystack analogy. And there, you know, are millions of kids whose names you never hear who end up not making it. And then, you know, if they make it to Europe, having to go home or never make it at all. And they have to try and figure out how to kind of readjust their sights and come to grips with the fact that this dream they've had since they were a kid didn't work out. And what are they going to end up doing with the rest of their life? That was the part of the book that I think resonated with me the most. And I actually continue to personally try and help some of these kids who are struggling, Bernard in particular. I've been trying to figure out a way to get him some sort of employment that he could take care of himself and his children, maybe as a taxi driver or something like that. But I you know, I feel his pain on a regular basis. And then in terms of your second question about kind of why the program failed or didn't achieve the success. I mean, I do think that the age cheating was a big problem. I do think that you need to get that right in order to, you know, have a significant enough probability of success to make it worthwhile. But as you point out, there were other factors as well. I mean, you know, for the boys who went to Doha, there was the challenge of trying to, you know, integrating into a life that was so different from what they had experienced before. And also they were playing against a bunch of Qatari kids who were not as good as them. So they didn't really have the challenge on the field day in and day out that they would have really needed to improve. Now that's true for them, but that actually ended up being a quite small number that went to Doha. Most of the kids ended up going to this satellite academy in Senegal, where they trained most of the Football Dreams kids. And that setting was, you know, much more akin to what they would have experienced where they grew up. I mean, the conditions of the academy there were nicer than they would have had if they had stayed back home. But the surrounding area of Sali, Senegal, is again more akin to what they would have been used to at home. So the culture shock wasn't as stark for the kids that ended up going to Senegal. So I do think age cheating had a bigger impact than, say, culture shock. In terms of the, you know, you mentioned the challenge of a boy who's 14 in Africa competing with a boy who's 14 in Europe. I do think that's true, but I think, you know, the two components of that are, one, you know, if you're looking at it, a problem writ large, there's a nutritional issue, right? I mean, you know, you have in many places in Africa, malnourishment is a real problem. And so physically, a boy in Africa who's 14 may not be equivalent to a boy who's 14 in Europe. But, you know, potentially an even bigger issue or as big an issue is that, you know, they don't have the organized structures to train youth players in Africa that they do in Europe. So, you know, you might have a kid who's 14 in Barcelona, who's been in Barcelona's academy in some form or fashion since he was 5, 6, 7 years old. And he's been getting that, you know, training, you know, for years and years and years. A kid who's 14 growing up in, you know, someplace in Ghana, for example, isn't going to have had access to that quality of training. Now, there is an advantage that comes from probably the amount of pickup soccer and street soccer that kid in Ghana is probably playing. But in order to really succeed, you kind of need both. You need the sort of game intelligence that comes from playing a lot of pickup soccer, but you need that, you know, more formalized training environment that you get at the European Academy. So I think that is definitely one of the things that holds European players back, not having that organized structure. And that's actually what Joseph Colomer realized when he first came up with the idea for Football Dreams. The way it happened was he was at Barcelona, and while he was there as youth director, he was invited to Senegal to scout for kids for Barcelona. He'd never been to Africa to scout before, and he was just blown away by the level of raw talent. But he realized that they didn't have the same system of academies that they have in Europe to train these young players in a systemized fashion. And so he thought to himself, man, if you could somehow do a kind of a large scale talent search and get the best kids and then put them into, you know, the kind of academy system you have in Europe, man, you could produce superstars. But when he first thought of the idea at Barcelona, he thought it was too ambitious, too expensive for anyone to do, even the biggest clubs in the world. And it wasn't until he linked up with Sheikh Jassim in Qatar, one of the richest people in the world, that he actually found someone to bankroll his idea.
Thank you. And Andrew wants to pick up on that.
Well, yeah, I wanted to follow up on the age cheating just in relation to the structure of the book, but I'd first mention I really did love the book also, just like
thanks.
A lot of other people, but I used it in a summer class I taught that was centered around the World Cup and kind of looking at both sociological and psychological issues, and it was great for that. And in fact, I guess if I'm asking about the structure of the book, I might weave in a couple pieces related to that. So the age cheating follow-up is just the question of how that was woven into the book, because in my reading and my students' reading during the summer, once you got to that chapter 8, where you learn that these kids are just way older than anybody thinks, and you know, I completely agree with Brian. There's a lot of other issues at the macro level, but if you're just looking at individual kids, you cite some of these kids who are 24 and playing in the U17 World Cup, and it's clear that there's just in terms of identifying individual talent, it's just that's one of the core issues that's going on here. And so I'm curious why it felt kind of like the book changed at that point at about halfway through in chapter 8, when you learn these kids are just much older. And I'm just curious your thinking in terms of structuring the book, whether you thought about foreshadowing that a little more, or if you wanted to just relay it in the same, it sounds like it was sort of the way you learned about it. Like at first you kind of trusted that they knew what they were doing, and then it turns out they really didn't. I guess if I'm going to add on another structure question related to the book, it would be that I loved also the way you wove in a bunch of, I think, interesting social science about kind of talent development and about performance and about trying to us and that, you know, the challenges of just doing that anywhere. And again, that seemed particularly heavy in the front part of the book. And then in the end, again, it seemed like it shifted more, as you said, towards what happens to the kids and the tensions around investing so much of themselves into this and then not succeeding. So that'd be my other kind of structure question. I also just would be curious how people have responded to the book as by way of kind of setup. Obviously I have lots of other questions, but just in terms of the book itself,
right.
Be very curious to hear about all that. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thanks for your question, and thanks for reading and teaching the book. That's very cool. I guess I'll just start with the last question first, which is just, I mean, the response has been fantastic. I mean, anyone who is an author, and this is my first book, so it's my first experience being a published author, but anyone who's a journalist or who's writing anything and putting it out there, you know, knows you're always kind of putting yourself out there whenever you're putting your work out, written work out there. And especially with something like this that I spent 4 years on and, you know, it was, I kind of poured everything into, you're a little bit anxious about what is the response going to be once the book is actually out, but it's been great. I've gotten a ton of really good feedback from, you know, a whole host of folks, not just sort of hardcore soccer fans, but, you know, other people who have read the book who have told me, you know, I'm not a soccer fan at all. I don't know or care that much about soccer, but I couldn't put your book down. And so that was really heartening to me, because that's what I tried to do. It. I tried to write the book so that somebody who was a hardcore soccer fan would find it really interesting, but also somebody who is maybe just more interested in the narratives of these boys and where they came from and what happened to them would find it interesting as well. So in terms of your first question about the age cheating issue and, you know, the how I structured it, it's both partly kind of how I came to, kind of realize how big an issue it is, but more than that, kind of how it manifested itself as an issue within the history of the program. Because, at the beginning, it seemed like the folks who were running the program, again, were a bit naive in terms of how big an issue this was. And so that's why I thought at the beginning, not sort of foreshadowing it or kind of pointing to it as a big issue made sense, because it seems like they went through this process where they thought, okay, well, we're asking kids for a birth certificate or a school ID. And so that's proof, and they have to bring that to us. And if that says that they're the right age, then they must be the right age. And, you know, we'll hold our tryouts, and then we'll do our ultimate testing once they get to Doha for the final tryout, even though that's pretty late in the process, because the way the tryouts worked in every country, they would hold, you know, tryouts for 50 to 100,000 kids, depending on the country, at fields all over the country, and then bring the best 50 to the capital for a final country tryout, and then the best 50 from all of the countries to Doha for a final tryout. So once you've got to that point where the best 50 of all of the countries are in Doha, that's pretty late to kind of be testing the kids. But that was sort of the system they set up. And so I thought it made sense to kind of let the reader go on that same journey with them. They're picking these kids. They think they're really good. And the moment that I reveal it in, you know, when Diwandu is kicked off the Senegalese national team, is the first real moment in the program when, if they didn't realize that this was a big issue, they should have. Because they're like, well, wait a minute, this, you know, one of our star players was kicked off his national team because they're saying he's too old. And so that made sense to me to kind of be the point to reveal to the reader that, you know, it isn't all what it seems, which again would have been the experience possibly of the folks who were organizing the program to begin with. And then, you know, once that happened, I mean, look, there's plenty of players from Africa who have lied about their ages over the years who have probably gone on to succeed in Europe. And so it doesn't mean that if you do say you're older than you are, that you're bound to fail. It just means that the probability of success is lower. So, you know, in my mind, I didn't think to myself, okay, at that point when you realize that there are kids lying about their ages, that it means that everyone's bound to fail. And you see that that's not true, because there are players who have gone on to succeed in the program. You know, Moussa Wage was on Senegal's World Cup team, scored the goal in a World Cup, was the youngest player from Africa ever to score a goal in the World Cup, and is now at Barcelona. Henry Onyekuru was the leading scorer in the Belgian First Division, was bought by Everton, went to Anderlecht, and is now in Turkey, and he's done very well. So I don't know exactly how old those players are, because I didn't follow them in detail, but I would be surprised if they're exactly the age that they said. but they have succeeded, and other players have as well, because some players, even though they may be lying about their age, may be good enough that when they get to the point that they're competing against the same players their age, that they're good enough, they can handle it. And so that was sort of the thinking about how I structured it in the book. And then in terms of, you know, outlining the science of, you know, talent identification, the reason I sort of put that a bit more at the beginning of the book is because I thought it corresponded with, you know, the narrative of the tryouts, that you have these scouts and they're trying to pick which of these kids are the best. And so I was trying to give the reader some grounding to help them understand about the factors that are most important and what scouts get right and what they sometimes get wrong, and what Joseph Colomer and the other scouts were likely thinking when they were watching these kids on the field, trying to select which ones they thought they had the most potential. You know, once the kids were selected, then I shifted to more of it being about the narrative of these boys and, you know, what happened to them, and what that said about a lot of things, about the big business of international soccer, about the Football Dreams program in particular, and just about, again, about the reality for these kids who had everything riding on this one dream, and what it meant for that not to work out. And part of that was just, I thought, in order to hold the reader's interest, that was really what was going to keep them going, wanting to know what happened to the boys over the years. And so that's why I kind of front-loaded that research at the beginning and then shifted more into a mode where it's mostly kind of narrative storytelling.
Thank you. Andrew, do you want to follow up, or is anyone there out there wanting to ask a question? Otherwise, I can insinuate myself here. There are two hands raised. I see. I'm not used to looking at those things. Itamar and Gerard, let's start with, since it's a book having to do with Qatar, let's go to Qatar and hear from Gerard.
Yes, but I don't have much to do with Qatar. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I'm in Senegal now, and I just interviewed Lamine Savané, who was in charge of the whole Aspire program from the beginning. And
when did you interview him?
Last week, and I just saw him today again. Yeah. Right. But the reality I'm getting from this, it's there's two things. First, I don't consider that this program was a failure per se. It is just the nature of these academies. They are costly, they are complex, and their ambition with a continental vision was even more complex. They're just meant to be difficult to sustain. And the outcome, it is normal to any academy outcome in terms of who do you detect. It's a very random business. A child that looks talented in when he's 13, 12, doesn't mean that he's going to get anywhere when he's 20. It's just the nature of it. And the other thing, it's the age problem cannot be a factor of failure. It can be a factor of reducing maybe the success, but it cannot be a factor of failure for the whole program, because all the other academies have similar challenges with ages, with kids who change their age. There's many ways that they manage to get through these programs by changing their age, but some of them still get through. Then the other thing is we tend to look at football in Africa sometimes out of the socioeconomic context. The failure of the kids who don't make it are mostly due to the fact that there's nothing after football. First, most of them were not school before they entered the program. Then when they don't succeed in football, their chances to do anything is very, very, very limited. And all academies have a similar challenge. The kids who cannot make it to a professional career, they don't know what to do. And this is just the way the socioeconomic system is. Thousands, millions of kids are not schooled properly or are not schooled at all, and they end up on the streets after primary school or secondary school. And that's the reality. And football is just a small parenthesis in these kids' life. That's why more and more are looking to this academic system. They are extremely costly, complicated, and they just give an opportunity to a few kids to succeed, but most of them will fail, not because of football, but because the society doesn't have much to offer. That's the challenge. And the last aspect in terms of failure of this program is Qatar funded, completely funded by Qatar. And the day they decided to stop the program, it's not because of performance, it's because they cut their budgets. They don't want to support it anymore. What is the problem in most of Qatar sports system right now? They cut budgets. And from now, they are going to close the program, I think, in 2 years, completely close it, because the funding is not coming anymore, and it's an extremely costly program. That's my take on these academies in general, and that's why Academy has a specificity to be Pan-African, and amplify a few of the challenges the other academies have.
Thanks very much, Gerard, for your questions. And I'm glad you got a chance to meet Lamin. I hope he's doing well. He's a very nice guy. And if you see him again, please say hello to him for me. So in terms of your comments, I totally agree with you that, academy systems are complex, they're costly, and whether or not they are a success or a failure, I think it determines about, what lens do you look at them through? So you have lots of, big clubs out there in the world who have these academy systems. And there are many of them that have produced very, very high quality players. And so for most of these clubs, even though they are costly and the probability of picking superstars is small, they obviously think that from an economic perspective, they make sense because they continue to run them and they conceivably continue to produce players who make it make economic sense for them because they either save the amount of money it takes to buy that equivalent player later or they're able to sell players for big transfer fees. And so it's true that they are costly. It's true that it's complex, but it's not true that it never really works. And so in terms of the Football Dreams program, why I say I don't say that it is a complete failure, because obviously, there are players again that I mentioned, like Musa Wage and Henry Onyekuru, who have gone on to, players who are playing in the World Cup or players who are playing in Europe, which is the dream of obviously many, many kids who are growing up in Africa. But in terms of producing real big stars, the program hasn't necessarily produced what other people have anticipated in terms of the caliber of players. And this isn't my perspective. This is interviewing, a lot of other folks who are involved in youth soccer in Africa, other academies that have produced, good players like, Generation Foot that produced Sané, or Right to Dream, which has been producing some pretty good players that have come to the US or to Europe. And so, their perspective has been that given the amount of money that was put into the Football Dreams program, given the amount of money they were able, given them the number of kids that they were able to actually test, that they didn't understand why the players they were producing were not better than they were. So that was just their perspective. They thought even if you were getting the ages wrong, that if you were going to hold tryouts for over 5 million kids, that you would end up with at least a few who are really, really good. And so they thought that they were surprised, I guess, that the players that the program produced weren't better than they were given the amount of money that the Qatar had put into it. Again, they're very secretive about exactly how much money they put into it, but according to insiders in the program, they said it, you know, cost over a period of 10 years as much as $200 million. And given the number of kids that they were able to test, they thought that there would be, you know, better outcomes. And then in terms of, you know, the problem of the kids who, you know, have to go back to where they came from after not having made it, I agree that this is a huge problem. It's a big problem that there aren't a lot of opportunities for a lot of young people in lots of places in the developing world, including in Africa. And that, you know, there are a lot of kids who kind of place all their bets on soccer, and then when it doesn't work out, they don't know what else to do. And, you know, and soccer can contribute to that problem because, you know, there's research of players in Ghana who will drop out of school so that they can focus on playing soccer, hoping that that will be their ticket out. And if that doesn't work out, it only compounds their problem because they don't end up without an education. But, you know, I guess my point is for these programs is that, you know, they should, as much as they can, academies, not just in Africa, but in Europe, elsewhere, to make sure that as much as possible that kids have a plan B, which has to include education. And at Aspire, they did set it up for these kids to go to school, but, you know, the kids themselves didn't really see it as a priority. You know, they all thought that they were going to be the ones who would make it, so they didn't really think they would have to fall back on their education. And unfortunately, many of them did and didn't end up finishing the program with a high school diploma. So they didn't get that advantage that they could have had if they'd focused on education. I think the other things that these programs need to do, oftentimes a better job of, is helping these kids transition from the academy into whatever is going to come next, whether that be, you know, a team. If professional soccer is not going to work out, maybe it's going to be something else. I found with a lot of the Football Dreams kids that they struggled with that transition. When they didn't get to go to the team that Qatar owned in Belgium, they sort of felt like they didn't get enough support to find a different direction and ended up back home and were a little bit aimless. So I think both the focus on education and both the focus on that transition are important things, you know, not only for Football Dreams, but for all academies out there. Just looking at your list of comments here. Yeah, but I on the age issue, you know, the age cheating is definitely a factor, a big factor. It determines the success or failure of a program. Again, as I said before, it doesn't mean that if a kid is lying about his age that the probability of him succeeding goes to zero. It just is going to make it lower than it would be if you're dealing with a kid who's really the age that you think. And because the probabilities are so small to begin with, you're going to pick the right player. Again, you know, at Premier League academies in England, the percentage of kids who start at the under nine level who make it to the first team is 0.5%. And these are already the kids who are making it into the Premier Academy. So they are the kids who are seen at that young age as the best in their age group. Now, again, that's a small percentage. So if you're then picking kids who are much older than you think they are, that percentage is going to be even lower. And so it doesn't mean the percentage goes to zero, but it does mean that the probability of success is going to be lower if you are dealing with the age cheating problems. And I think that some of the academies in Europe and Africa that are starting to have the best success, like Right to Dream, based on my conversations with them, seem much more focused on the age issue and trying to make sure that kids were at least generally the age they said than I experienced with Football Dreams. But that was just my own personal experience.
Gerard, would you like to follow up? I see your hand up, and then we have Brian, and then I'm going to ask a question. And yes? Or is that the hand from before?
Yes, but just a quick follow-up on age. I spoke to the academy that is Jambas, probably older than Aspire. And they were very strict on the age at the beginning. They had to cancel a class when they started their recruitment. Their success of getting players, talented players, is not much better. And that's why the guy told me we have hard time to get players out, great players out. And Generation Foot, Sadio Mane, what I heard, just went through that academy for 4 months. Even not a product of the academy. 200 or 300 players were the product of the academy. The system is so random that we don't know. We don't know. That's the only thing I want to add.
Yeah, again, I totally agree with you that the success of other academies has been low. The big difference with Aspire is they spent far more money than any of those other academies that you would compare them against. And they've looked at many, 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 many times the number of kids. So you would think that then that would increase the likelihood of success, at least noticeably. If you have two groups, they basically have the same issue of trying to identify whether kids are the right age or not. But one gets to look at 10 times the number of kids and has 10 times the amount of money to spend. You would still think that probability of success would go up. Would it go up 10 times? I don't know. But you would think it would be higher than an academy that doesn't have that. But again, that's just, I'm just sort of relaying the perspective of other academies in West Africa that I spent time with and spoke to. That was their perspective.
Okay, let's go to Brian. And I think since it's about, the seventh minute of the second half, in the way that we mark time, maybe we can also start moving beyond the age cheating, because there's a lot of other interesting things in this book. Brian.
I will try to stay away from the age cheating aspect. Okay. What I have said before, or something I have as a personal opinion, academies are not the way for African football. They're being run like one of the most inefficient production lines, and people still want to invest in them. If you have a production line, and for every 100 outputs that are coming out, only 2 are succeeding, then you need to rethink the whole thing. And that's why I'm saying the whole project, the whole Aspire, selling a dream, future dreams, it's ill conceived. Just the fact that the academy system is working in Europe, where we also know the success rate is very low. Once when I came here, I once told somebody I really wanted to be a professional player. I don't know why I'm working. And he told me, look at the academy, where he gave me an article of the UEFA magazine where with this guy, Wesley Schneider and Hertinger were. And Wesley Schneider was saying, in his class, out of about 200 kids, only 2 of them made it to professional football. And for Africa, that has much wider and stronger impacts in terms of our socioeconomic development. That's why when I was reading this book, The Away Game, I was even more convinced that we need to rethink the way we are developing football in Africa, and more so the academies that we are putting in place.
Yeah, I think you make some very good points. I mean, you know, it's all about what the goal of the system is. Again, if the goal is to produce a small number of very, very high quality players, irrespective of, you know, the failure of the vast, vast majority, then, you know, perhaps academies are the best way. Because, you know, again, in Europe, it's proven, or at least it seems to be proven, that that's the best way to produce the highest quality players in that setting. Now, again, it's possible that it would do the same in Africa in terms of producing the highest quality players, but perhaps that's not the best system for Africa, because again, there's a huge cost to that failure, and perhaps it's not money well spent. I mean, again, if you have 98-99% of the kids who are going to fail, and then they have, you know, nothing to really fall back on, then maybe that's not a good societal investment. I mean, that's the point I often made about the Football Dreams program. I mean, that said, when people talk about the success or failure of it, you know, I say, well, you have to identify or clarify what lens you're looking at it through, because if you're looking at it as purely equivalent of, you know, any other kind of soccer academy, high-end elite soccer academy, where the goal is to just produce the best players it can find, then you could say, okay, well, it's mixed. It's been a mixed result, because they have, again, produced some players who are playing in the World Cup and players who played for youth national teams and are playing in Europe. And so that's obviously some level of success. Now, relative to how much money was put into it and how many kids they were able to actually test, you can, you know, debate whether or not that they had as much success as they should. Now, there's another lens to look at it, which is a lens that Aspire often mentioned, where they say it's a humanitarian program. And I say, okay, well, again, there are some aspects of it that, you know, are humanitarian. There are kids who went through the program who benefited in a way that they never would have if the program hadn't existed, and they were able to achieve their dream of playing in Europe, something they maybe they never would have done if it didn't exist. But if you're talking about it being sort of purely a humanitarian program, it's spending a huge amount of money on a small number of kids to begin with, just the kids that mainly get into the academy, although there was some other money they spent sort of distributing soccer gear and things like that. But most of the money was spent on a small number of kids in the academy. And then, as you rightly point out, you know that most of those kids are going to fail. That's just the way the probabilities shake out. And so you end up spending, you know, a huge amount of money on a small group of kids, knowing that the majority of them are not going to succeed. That's probably not a great humanitarian program. So if you wanted to spend money for more humanitarian reasons, then I agree with you. Then soccer academies probably aren't the best way to do it. There might be other ways you would spend your money where you distribute the gains more evenly across a wider number of kids, and you don't have the extreme success on one hand and then, you know, the negative outcomes for a lot of the kids on the other. So I think you make very good points.
Excellent, thank you. So that bridges nicely with what I wanted to bring up, which is that, you know, as an exercise in soft power, in many ways, this was a successful project in the sense that, you know, I see it as a PR operation by and large, part of a larger panoply of such activities that the Qataris have put on in the past few years. So really the material success doesn't matter all that much. And that brings up the question of education. This morning, there was a story that I tweeted from CNN quoting Giorgio Chiellini, captain of the greatest football team on the planet, you know, who's one of the few Italian players with a university degree. And he was quoted as saying, "We have to encourage more football players to study and increase the number with university degrees because life is long." And he also added, "Just being able to play football is not enough." And the article goes on to mention, you know, depression, substance abuse, poverty, and other issues that even those who make it after their careers have to grapple with. And the Qataris seemed utterly disinterested in this, frankly. And that is not just something that the Qataris are disinterested in. Many of the academies, particularly the less legitimate ones and the less scrupulous ones, are also disinterested. And you know, Liz and I have been working on this article, which we're happy to report will be coming out soon in the Journal of Southern African Studies, on a football academy in South Africa called the Zitwe, which has taken a very interesting approach, and that is that football and education go hand in hand. And this is a shoestring budget operation, you know, has basically was running on the equivalent of, what is it, $30,000 total for 6 years or thereabouts, with some help from some local sponsors, but totally run by local people, teachers, coaches, police officers, and others, with no real assistance from any major corporation. And their point was train 6 days a week and then also run study halls and empower these young kids, all boys, to succeed in school. And after 6 years, what Liz and I have found is that, in fact, most of them have not made it in the professional ranks, despite the fact that they spent probably 10,000 hours on training and that they're fantastic footballers, all of them. But, you know, as you point out in the book, an infinitesimally small proportion of these players can make a living from the game. But these young men in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, are able to rely on something else, which is they all matriculated from high school. Most of them are in college. Some have already graduated from college. They have a future. They have something in addition to football, even while they continue to play at various ranks, mostly in the third tier of South African football. And so, you know, I was really fascinated by kind of the scouting component of this book and the AI and the role of objective and subjective criteria. And yet you conclude, Sebastian, that in the end, you know, players like Diawandu, I mean, he had the qualities that you couldn't spot in the system that was created, which is why I think Brian and Gerard are kind of trying to point out that this was a system that was essentially set up to fail, so to speak, and that the structures and the context are so important. I mean, he had, as you say on page 246, you know, the qualities that put him over the top were much harder to spot in a match or a training session. His judgment, strength of character, self-discipline, motivation, these attributes made him a great leader. They also helped him make smart decisions off the field that proved just as important as those on it. And, you know, it's when you have these kinds of attributes and you have people around you, a community, a family, a network that nurtures them and that, you know, fosters your education, then you're in a position where you can succeed. Just going for this kind of talent search approach is not really going to do much good to the local players or the local communities. So there are alternatives out there. And I think those that really work are the ones that look at the child holistically, in a sense, because the baseline reality, as you say, is very grim.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I'm a big proponent of, you know, focusing on education, focusing on any sort of plan B, anything that's going to give players a safety net, because as Brian and Andrew and others have rightly pointed out on this call, the probabilities of success are just incredibly low. Even if you're doing everything right at an elite academy, the failure rate is going to be very high, because you know that precisely what you just said, Peter, the characteristics that are the most important are the most difficult to spot. And personality is number one. And then other things I talk about in the book, like game intelligence and vision, are also incredibly important and are much more difficult to really determine on an objective basis, like than how fast a kid is or how big he is or even how hard he can shoot or any of the sort of like technical qualities you might look for. And so I was just with the founder of an academy in Malawi called Chigoli here a few days ago, and he's trying to follow in the footsteps of Right to Dream and set up pathways for kids to use their soccer to get into schools here in the U.S., boarding schools in the U.S., because, you know, again, most of these kids are not going to be able to become professional, but if they can use their soccer in other ways to try and get them a leg up on education, a leg up on, you know, the professional world that they otherwise wouldn't have had, then I think that's fantastic. And again, it's not just academies in Africa that are often sort of paying lip service to the importance of education and not actually following through. I mean, and to the defense of the Aspire guys, I mean, I think you know, especially some of them in the program. And, you know, I think Ivan Bravo, the head of Aspire, who I think quite highly of, he's a Spanish guy who was head of strategy at Real Madrid before he went to Aspire. You know, I think they truly believed in the importance of education for these kids, and they did set it up again so these kids could go to private school there in Senegal where they were training. But it's not just enough really to kind of sort of say it's important. You need to sort of put it into practice and basically say you're not going to play unless you're getting the grades. You're not going to play unless you study. Those kinds of things that basically put education and soccer on the same level, not just verbally, but in practice. And I think that's not really what happens at most places. Most places might say, yeah, we, you know, education is really important to us and kids have a chance to go to school. But even in those places, are the kids allowed to play if they're not making the grades or not? And that's sort of, to me, kind of one of the key measures as to whether or not education is high enough in the hierarchy of priority or not.
Great, thank you. So the order is Daniel, Itamar, and then Gerard. And please keep your questions short and to the point because we have about 23 minutes left. Thank you.
Yeah, my internet connection is quite well. And my first question is, maybe you can a little bit elaborate on the issue of naturalization. I mean, one of the main conspiracy was the program set up to recruit players for the 2022 Qatari World Cup team. But as you explain in the book, then the rules on naturalization have changed during the process. And second topic, your 10th chapter is on Belgium and the German minority city in Qatar. I just checked online their squad for the season. There's not one Qatari player. Why are they not sending player to that club to make them more competitive? Saudi Arabia, for example, sends players now to Spain, even pays the salaries. So some that you discussed with...
Yeah, you cut in a little bit.
We're losing you,
Danielle, but I think I got the gist of it. Question about naturalization and about why there aren't any Qatari players on the team in Belgium. First, in terms of naturalization, you know, I agree that I think at the beginning the goal of Football Dreams was to improve the Qatari national team. And, you know, ostensibly the rationale, at least publicly, was that the best Qatari players in the academy at Aspire didn't have the competition they needed to compete day in and day out to be improving in the way they would need to be if Qatar was actually going to produce a top-level national team. And that Qatar didn't have the population needed to give the best kids in each age group that kind of competition. So they would go to Africa, they would try and find the best young kids, and then they would bring them to Doha to compete against the Qataris and raise the level. At least that was sort of what was publicly stated. But I think, you know, look, Qatar has a long history of naturalizing of foreign players in all sorts of different sports. You know, they've done it with Kenyan sprinters, Bulgarian weightlifters, and my personal favorite was the Chinese chess grandmaster that they naturalized. But, and so I think, and they even said it at the beginning when I asked back in 2008 whether these kids were going to play for Qatar. And at the beginning they said, well, we're not going to require them to play for Qatar, but if they're here and they want to, we'll let them. Now, they eventually changed their tune over the years, and they said these kids will not play for Qatar. They're going to play for their own national teams. And I think they did that for two reasons. I do think that, as you mentioned, FIFA tightened the rules. They made it more difficult to naturalize young players. It used to be a player could switch nationality after living in the new country for 2 years at any age. And then not long after Football Dreams started, they changed that so that a player has to live in the new country for 5 years after turning 18. So that it made it less feasible to naturalize these kids, because these kids all wanted to go to play in Europe, but they didn't want to play in Qatar. And then the other component was that there was a lot of criticism, public international criticism, about naturalizing these kids. You know, I mean, there were folks who just saw it as a form of neocolonialism, you know, a rich country going to a bunch of much poorer countries and harvesting their best young players. So I think that the other reason you didn't see attempts to naturalize the Football Dreams kids was because it was too much in the spotlight. It would, you know, basically get too much criticism. Whereas Qatar continued to naturalize lots of foreign players, including African players, but they just did it outside of the Football Dreams program, where there was less public scrutiny. And so that's the story on naturalization. In terms of Qatari players at their team in Belgium, they have sent Qatari players there over the years to try and get them more international experience, to get them European soccer experience, to try and improve the team ahead of the 2022 World Cup. The thing is, most of their players aren't good enough to play on the team in Belgium. I mean, and this was true when they were in the second division, although when they were in the second division, you would see occasionally some Qatari players play. And I spoke to the coach, the former coach of that team when they were in the second division, Tintin, and he said actually over time he was getting more and more pressure to play more Qatari players to get them experience, which he thought was difficult to do and sustain the team's performance. Right now you don't really see any Qataris on the team. I think that's because they're now in the first division, so the level is even higher, and they had a hard time even staying up in the first division last year, and so maybe they've made the decision that, you know, they can't play Qatari players on that team and continue to stay in the first division. They have other teams that they bought in other parts of Europe now, in Spain, and I think in Austria as well. And I haven't looked at those teams, but they're in lower divisions. So maybe you see more Qatari players on those teams than the one in Belgium. But it's definitely been an evolution. And in Belgium, you may have Qatari players playing with the reserves or the under-21s, that kind of thing, but just not with the first team.
Thank you. Gerard, and then, no, excuse me. Did I say Gerard? Is it Gerard? No, Itamar, and then Gerard, sorry.
Yes, hello everybody, and thank you very much, Sebastian, for this important contribution of your work. And I'm actually turning my dissertation, which dealt with football academies in Ghana, and your book will definitely find its way to my updated literature review. Oh, so I'm very excited that you wrote your this book. I was wondering if you had a chance to hear about the perspectives of national federations like the Ghana Football Association, how they viewed the engagement of Aspire, and how they viewed this dynamic of Aspire coming and recruiting some of the Ghanaian players or other West African countries. And so that's one thing. And the other thing I was wondering about your perspective, if whether they have changed while you were working on this project concerning this body of knowledge that we call sport and development, whether you changed your mind or whether some things that you've seen changed the way you see this connection between sport and development and how sport or soccer, football can serve as an avenue for social cohesion or various of other things. So these are my brief questions for now. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. I'm glad that the book made it into your literature review, and good luck on your dissertation. My wife has a doctorate, so I know how much work that is. So in terms of perspectives of the national federations, you know, I spent time during my research in Ghana, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and Nigeria and West Africa, and met with federation officials in all of them. And to be honest, the perspectives varied. There wasn't sort of just one perspective. And I think that that's because, you know, I think that there's some turnover at these different organizations, different federations. And so the level of interaction or knowledge of what the Football Dreams folks were doing differed at the different federations and with the different folks I met at the different federations. So you would hear everything from, you know, support for what Football Dreams was doing, that this was good for the development of players in the country and for the national team. I heard that most in Senegal because that's where the Football Dreams Satellite Academy was located, and there were very tight ties between the academy and the federation, and lots of players from the academy had played for Senegal's youth national team, and so there tended to be very positive perspectives from those federation folks. In other countries, it was a bit more mixed. You had some officials kind of with a lot of suspicion about what Football Dreams was doing, about whether or not they should try and exert more control over what Football Dreams was doing. Maybe there was a bit of envy that Football Dreams had so much money to work with, and why isn't more of that money being funneled towards the federation? There were also some gripes. I can't remember if this was, I think this was in Senegal from folks at, you know, maybe in the federation and at other academies, about why Football Dreams didn't field a team to play in the league there in Senegal, instead of simply, developing kids to eventually send to Belgium. The one thing that kind of surprised me in general about Football Dreams, and it wasn't so much when I met with federation officials, but it was just kind of more generally when I met with folks who were involved in youth soccer in Africa, was how kind of little knowledge there was about the Football Dreams program in general. I mean, it was such a massive program, and there was so much money being poured into it. But you spoke with a lot of people, and they didn't quite understand it. They had heard of Aspire, they'd heard of Football Dreams, they didn't really know what the program was doing. And I sort of chalk that up to the fact that, you know, the program was fairly secretive. I think that's generally true of Qatar and many things that they do. And I think that filtered through the Football Dreams. And so it was often difficult for people to get access to the program and really see what they were doing, including journalists. And so there was a lot of confusion, suspicion about what was actually going on with the program. And then the second question, in terms of did I change my mind in terms of my perspective on sport and development? I continue to think soccer is a wonderful thing for, the development of kids in so many ways. I mean, it was a huge part of my childhood growing up and continues to be today. I played yesterday I played a men's league in the morning on Tuesdays here in New York, and it continues to be, the highlight of my week. And so it's got a lot of benefits in terms of, learning teamwork and determination and motivation and perseverance, and so that's true kind of, at the general level of, I think, what soccer can provide. It's, I guess, the way the book kind of altered my perspective or more fully informed my perspective was, again, at the elite level, about how it can be really quite cutthroat, and that there are a lot of downsides to this elite production of, very, very high level soccer players that I didn't really think about, especially in the developing world context, like places in Africa. And so I think I understand now more of, what I write about in my book and what we've been talking about on the call today, which is that there are some real downsides that need to be considered when money is put into, these academy systems. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be academy systems. There can still be benefit in terms of doing that. It just needs to make sure that they're partnered with, again, as we've said on the call, education, things that will allow the kids to have a safety net, a plan B, if soccer doesn't work out. And it's interesting, if you're reading up on the sports scientists, there's a lot of sports scientists who are really down on talent identification in soccer in general, because they basically say that, you know, it's so hard to identify, you know, which kids at a young age have the potential to really make it, that you're much better off just rather than trying to whittle down to small groups of kids every year, to try and keep as many kids in the system as possible and then weed them out over a longer period of time. And there's some interesting research that's been done on the German youth national team that looked at, you know, this, the makeup of kids on the German youth national team. And one, they found out that the turnover every year was like 40%, which is incredibly high, which tells you that every year there's a lot of a differing opinion about which kids are actually the best. And then I think it actually showed that the younger you make the German youth national team, the lower your probability of actually making it to the senior team, which means that the kids who are identified very young are not necessarily as the best ones, aren't necessarily the ones that end up progressing in the way that they end up the best ones at the end of the day. And so I guess that also kind of informs my perspective on, you know, the academy system and kind of what is the really the best way to kind of balance the production of the best players and try and minimize the downside risks for the kids who don't make it.
Thank you. Okay, we've got less than 9 minutes left. So let's turn it over to Gerard and then Andrew. And if we have time, Danielle, before we close. Over to you, Gerard.
Okay, my first comment is about academies. You know, when you look at the African map, the dominant countries are the ones who have academies.
The which
and that
countries?
Is the dominant countries in terms of football.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except North Africa is the one with academies. And that becoming very, very appealing to most countries to develop. Everybody wants an academy. Mm-hmm. Without knowing exactly what it means. The other thing, when Peter talked about education, from all the people I've met here with academies, okay, Diamba said that they put education first. But when they recruit the kid, a 12-year-old kid to 13-year-old kid who hadn't been to school, it becomes a challenge for them to educate these kids. And that's the ground they work with. They work with a lot of kids that will be recruited for their football talent, but haven't been to school. Right. And they are challenged with schooling these kids. Right. And that's one element. The second element, it is one of the guys I interviewed told me, we created these academies first for football. Mm-hmm. Education comes after.
Right.
And for the academy to survive, we need to get a few kids out of the system to generate some revenue. Then the priority, it is football. What makes the education parameter very, very, very low on the scale of what is a priority? Right. You have the education, basic education system, and then you have the priority of academies. Right. And it is very, very difficult to convince. I don't try to convince them, but just asking them the question, where is education? They tell you, yes, we do our best, but, you know, we work with what we have. Yeah. And this is not football. In wrestling, it's even worse. Mm-hmm. It's even worse. Yeah. Right. That's just a comment.
Right. I agree. Again, I think that, you know, I mean, that guy's being very honest with you, which is, I think, is rare. I mean, I think a lot of times that academies will just say that, yeah, education is as important as football for us. When in reality, as you're pointing out, it's not. They clearly have a priority of producing players, and education is the second. I think it's why, again, you know, I spent some time at Right to Dream, not a ton of time, but I've spent a bit of time with them. And I thought one interesting thing that they do is they have, you know, a system where there are kids that they are, they're holding tryouts for, and they're looking for both kind of their level of skill on the field, but also their academics, because they have this pipeline where they help kids get into schools here in the U.S. using their soccer, but the kids need to have enough of an academic basis to make that work. And so they're actually not just looking at a kid's skill on the field when they're recruiting. They're looking at both academics and soccer skill, which I think is an interesting model.
Andrew.
It wouldn't be a good academic pilata without worrying about privatization and neoliberalism and all that, right? So I feel like the part of the point for me in relation to the academies is that if you turn this whole thing over to basically private business interests, you know, with these club teams and the sports system, that it's inevitably going to be bad for kids and for communities. So I worry about that even in the U.S. with the MLS teams developing these academies that preclude kids from going to from playing high school, and that sort of take kids, you know, out of the system at very, very young ages, and commit them entirely to the small possibility that you note very well in the book. Even in England or Germany, it's just a tiny possibility. So I guess the one thing that is, it's too long a question for the time we have remaining, but I was intrigued in the book when you talked about it. It sounded like the one of the schools in Senegal was actually designed to be a kind of sports school that was part of the Senegalese system. Mm-hmm. And it always is surprising to me how little any of these programs make an effort to collaborate with the actual local school systems or the local systems that are already in place, that it seems to me like you could put some money into some of those systems and they already have the organic connections in the community and they already have the opportunities to identify players, and they're going to be just much more grounded in the community rather than just, again, bringing in external systems that, even if they're sending kids to American prep schools, it's only going to be one or two kids. It's not really going to make much difference. So I don't know. I mean, is it just an inevitable tide, or do you see any hope for those kinds of alternatives?
No, it's difficult, right? Because, you know, in terms of the alternative to privatization, you know, is obviously, you know, having the public sector do it, the government do it. And, you know, there would be a benefit to that in terms of the potential benefits maybe distributed more widely. I think the challenge of doing that in some of the places that I've seen in West Africa is that, you know, a lot of the governments aren't necessarily the most efficient, and, you know, corruption is a problem. And so I think you've seen that with the performance of national teams in many of these countries from West Africa, where, you know, the talent is there. You know, you have players playing in the highest leagues in the world, but oftentimes the national team seem to underperform. And one of the reasons is that, you know, there are constantly questions about organization, about corruption, about where the money is going. You know, you have players who, you know, are getting to the World Cup and are, you know, boycotting because they haven't gotten their bonuses. And so I think there are some challenges with trying to rely on, you know, the public sector in some of these places because of those issues. I also think, like, if you're thinking about, you know, academies that are there partnering with schools and things like that, I think that it is a good idea. And so, you know, these academies do kind of partner with the schools in terms of trying to access kids. You know, they're just looking to try and access the kind of widest pool of kids that they want. What they don't want to do is delegate the responsibility for picking which kids are the best, because I think they've found that that's not always done honestly. That, you know, you find sometimes, at least in what folks have told me, that there's the risk that, you know, somebody just picks their kids or their relatives' kids or somebody they know, or somebody gives them some money and they pick those kids, which is, you know, again, allegations you hear at the youth national team level of some of these places where, you know, coaches are taking money to put kids on the team. So I think it's a good question. But I do think it's a challenging environment to try and institute kind of a perfect alternative to a privatization.
Thank you. We are now in added time. So Brian in Geneva, you get the last word.
Thank you. I'll just be quick and I'll try to make it as a comment on it to respond to this. Just following up on Andrew's comment, I'm actually trying to think of a school-based approach when it comes to football development, especially in Africa. I believe this would be the right approach, especially if you're thinking about sports for development, which was also mentioned earlier. And also in your book, or rather in our discussion today, we don't look at what these academy approach does the talent that remains behind. You know, when you take out the best, those who are left are not necessarily bad, but when you take out the best, then their progress is stifled. So as this article that was shared here earlier in the Atlantic, they say, talk about, instead of taking these people to academies and these centers of excellence, maybe they can, as a different approach, invest in upgrading just the basic infrastructure that in Africa, at least where I come from in Kenya, is normally found in schools, which allows players like Appiah to remain in the country for longer, help other kids also grow their talent for a more sustainable system in terms of football development or talent development, if I can say that. Thank you.
Yeah, I do think that, again, is a good point. I mean, I'm starting to feel a little bit like a show for Right to Dream. But Right to Dream actually has an interesting program where, because they have a limited number of kids that they can host actually at their residential academy. So I don't know where they are with this, because it's a few years ago that I spoke to them about this plan, but they were going to partner with schools in different parts of Ghana, where they thought that the, you know, schools had sufficient academics, and they were going to help upgrade the facilities at those schools, so that rather than having kids come and just being at the Right to Dream facility, that they could have kids stay in different schools. I don't know how many they were partnering with, but that way they could access more kids and keep them in their, you know, home environment, but they would have access to kind of better facilities, better coaching than they did now. So that's kind of an interesting model that sort of conforms to what you're talking about, but I don't know how far along they are with that. I know they were trying to raise some money to do that.
All right. I think we are now out of time. So I'd like to thank everybody who participated, and especially Sebastian for joining us. It's been a great discussion about this genuinely global book that connects West Africa, the Persian Gulf, and Europe in such fascinating ways. And I'm sure we could keep talking for another hour and a half if we could. But please keep in touch with us, Sebastian, and everybody else. Before we go, there is another session planned for December. I don't even want to think about December right now, but I must. On the 13th of December, Stefan Szymanski and Silk Maria Wynek will be with us to discuss It's Football, Not Soccer, and Vice Versa. And that should prove to be an interesting conversation, and we no longer will have to be paranoid or self-conscious about using the word soccer anymore, I think, at the end of this session. So, yes, thanks, everyone, and take care, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, and I just want to say, Peter, thanks so much for hosting me, and thanks to everyone who participated. They were great questions, and I thought it was a really good discussion.
Brilliant. Thank you. Take care, everyone.